And then, at least on LinkedIn, you go by the Director of Spirit Research and Innovation. Is there a different title?
That is the title. Under my protest, that is the title that they gave me.
Okay.
Yeah.
You don't like it?
No, well, I mean, it's long and unnecessary for what I mean, I'm a director, but there's only one person in my division, which is me.
Well, it's, so it sounds like, better than like manager or senior manager.
I mean, I wish they would have called like whiskey research. Like when I say spirit research, people think like I'm a ghost hunter, like something like that.
This is Bourbon Pursuit, the official podcast of bourbon, bringing to you the best in news, reviews, and interviews with people making the bourbon whiskey industry happen, and I'm one of your hosts, Kenny Coleman. Every few months, we find a guest that scratches that itch. We want to get into the science of bourbon, and today, we're talking about wood. And everyone has a different answer when it comes to the question of, how much influence does the barrel have on the whiskey? Is it 20%? 90? Is it 70%? Well, our guest today is going to help us get closer to finding that magic number. Andrew Wiebrink is the Director of Spirit Research and Innovation at Independent Stave Company. And his job is to get real deep and nerdy into wood, but not only just the wood, but the millions of permutations that you can have when it affects the taste of your whiskey. And we ask all the questions that you want to know about the effects of different char levels, toasting, stave seasoning, and storage, but not on just a scientific level, but also a hypothetical level. And his role at Independent Stave has him working on multi-year experiments with different wood varietals and aging conditions to see what hasn't been discovered yet. He's worked directly with Maker's Mark to create those finishing staves that you see used in their private barrel program. And lastly, we try to figure out, why would Maker's even consider getting rid of that mocha stave? Well, with that, enjoy this week's episode. And now here's Fred Minnick with Above the Char.
I'm Fred Minnick, and this is Above the Char. This week's idea, I dip back into an idea from October. You got to realize, folks, that I do one Above the Char a week, and I get probably 10 to 20 requests a week. And, you know, there's a big pile I have. I go through them, and I pick what I think are the best questions. And this one was actually focused on a news item, which was the Heaven Hill strike. And John Mulville, who wrote me on fredminnick.com, Mulvihill, I hope I said that right, want to know what the status and implications of the Heaven Hill strike were and want to know if there are going to be issues similar that we saw at Heaven Hill. Now, at the time, he was probably wanting to know my opinion on that. We gave our opinion on a roundtable on this and then just kind of let it play out. But this is a good question because these strikes happen all the time. In fact, you know, when Peoria, Illinois was hot and heavy with the largest distillery in the world at the time, Hiram Walker, you know, there were people going to the hospital, possibly body bags from all the union issues that they had there. It was a really messy time in Illinois for all unions. And the Peoria, Illinois Hiram Walker distillery was right there in the thick of it. And they just, you know what? They just didn't pay their people, you know? They didn't pay their people. And the people were fed up, and they striked. The more recent ones, we have seen basically every major distillery, Heaven Hill, Jim Beam, Four Roses, they have almost all gone on strike. And Brown Foreman, I think, was close. I think they were close. I think they had the real last second they struck a deal. But everyone has had these labor agreements come up and be very much discussed. And the fact is, bourbon is growing. And if you don't take care of your employees, you know, I mean, you got to take care of your employees. I'm not saying that's what they're doing, but the employees often don't feel like they're getting taken care of at the rate that bourbon is growing. Now, the other side is distilleries often have their money tied up in things that it looks like they're making a lot of money because they have all these warehouses, they have all these sales going, but there's stuff tied up in taxes. There's all sorts of products that aren't doing as well as bourbon that's in a portfolio. So, I mean, it's a complicated issue. But to answer your main question, John, this is not going to go away, and it will continue every single time. I expect every time a a labor contract is up, I expect a strike. I really do. How long the strike lasts, I can't say, but I expect one every single time because they're, you know, they're just trying to get all they can, and the distilleries are not coming to the table with a package that the labor unions want. So I don't think this is going to go away, and it's going to run through the distilleries over the next few years. As long as bourbon is popular, I expect to see strikes. Well, that's going to do it for this week, folks. Make sure you hit me up on fredminnick.com like John did. Hit me up on fredminnick.com. Click the contact button and let me know your thoughts. What do you want to know? Just don't be disappointed if I don't read it for like 1,000 years like I did John. Sorry about that, John. But that's going to do it this week, folks. Be safe out there. Until next week, cheers.
It's that time of the year where everybody's starting to make their vacation plans on visiting Kentucky, the mecca of bourbon. And if you are coming to Kentucky, you need to make sure you visit us at Pursuit Spirits in Louisville. We're right in the heart of Clifton, near Butchertown and Nulu, and only just a few miles away from downtown Louisville. But when you do come, you need to book your experience to go do our whole shebang. This is the one that's really the star of the show. You get a full-on tasting. You get to do your own personal barrel selection experience. And you get to grab a whiskey thief and fill your bottle directly from the barrel. We're doing something completely brand new that nobody else is doing here in bourbon country. Plus, you get a free sweet tasting glass at the end of it. I guarantee you, you're going to end up being one of the many people that's also leaving us a 5-star review. So make sure you come and check us out. You can book your reservation by going to pursuitspirits.com and clicking the Visit Us button.
It's that time again to get bourbon strong with Give270. Purchase your $50 tickets for your chance to win from our 50 bourbon prizes. Don't miss out on rare bottles and grand prizes like the legendary Pappy Set, a Weller Rainbow, and the Blood Oath Trilogy. Hurry, only 3,000 tickets are available. Single bottle winners go back in for the grand prize draw. Will you win the ultimate Pappy Set or one of our other incredible prizes? Get your tickets now at Give270.org. Charitable gaming license ORG 000273.
From their bar to yours, Chad and Sarah of the popular YouTube channel It's Bourbon Night bring you their favorite at-home old-fashioned mix with the new Elemental Elixirs Golden Hour Syrup. It's a custom-made syrup with notes of bold black tea, warm spices, and orange zest. All you need is your favorite whiskey and ice. No bitters needed. One bottle makes 16 drinks, so that's only $1 cocktail before you add your own whiskey. They can also be enjoyed in other cocktails or spirits, mocktails, coffee, tea, and anything you can think of. It's crafted locally in Lexington, Kentucky, and you can get your bottle now at whiskeyambitions.com. Welcome back to another episode of Bourbon Pursuit, the official podcast of bourbon. Kenny and Ryan here tonight in the recording studios talking about something that is very critical to the bourbon aging process, the barrel.
Right? Maybe the most critical. I mean, some say, I can't remember the percentages. I've been on so many damn tours and they say it, but they say most of the flavor comes from the barrel. And
60%, 70%, the numbers get thrown around.
Yeah, but whatever it does, it's magic and it works. So I'm so excited to dive into it and see what's going on. It's such a huge part of the industry, and well, the whole spirits industry really is all about the wood. So I'm really interested to hear or deep dive into it a little more.
Yeah, I mean, it is the backbone of really what this industry is made off of, and what gives bourbon everything that we like about it, the vanilla, the caramel, the coloring. And we're going to, as Ryan said, kind of dive deep into this because we're joined by Andrew Weebrink. I said it right. We were going this over and before we started recording that the name gets butchered all the time wherever he goes, but he is the Director of Spirit Research and Innovation at Independent Stave Company. Andrew, welcome to the show.
Hey, thanks for having me, guys. Appreciate it.
So before we dive into it and start getting into the bourbon and nonsense, kind of talk about your background and your history of what led you here. I mean, we were talking beforehand. We both went to the same alma mater, same high school. And I'm not sure if you knew at that point you wanted to get into researching wood and Quercus alba and all that sort of stuff, right? So no, kind of talk about your journey.
Yeah, definitely not. I'm actually a mechanical engineering major. So I went to University of Louisville right after high school, and I'm a bourbon fan first and foremost before, you know, spirit research or whiskey research or whatever. So I've always been into bourbon. That was probably due to my dad. He worked for the government, and his offices were ex Buffalo Trace warehouses. So he worked right next door to the distillery, which those offices are now warehouses again. So bourbon was kind of always around. So naturally, he took an interest in it. I took an interest in it. And that's pretty much where it ended as far as, you know, like academic endeavors. As far, I mean, it just had no interest in pursuing it as a career. About 6 or 7 years into my engineering, I started a bourbon and cigar review website called The Barrel and Leaf. I did that for a little while and really kind of got into it. And then we had a project come up with the company that I worked for, and it was designing a machine that froze alcohol into ice cubes for the service industry. It was called Beyond Zero or something like that.
I was about to say, isn't that impossible? Everybody kind of throws, I mean, I remember being in college, you throw Goldschlager and Jägermeister in the freezer. The idea is that it doesn't freeze, but it's easier to drink.
Yeah, it was a challenging process. I mean, you can always use, you know, liquid nitrogen, that gets pretty cold, but this was...
Guess you could go that route.
This was something they wanted you to like be able to plug into a wall and just be, you know, totally mechanical, not have any kind of introduction of chemicals or anything. So it was actually, you know, we did that project for about 2 years. So I kind of took a deep dive into alcohol, the way it behaves under certain conditions and stuff like that. Obviously, I loved bourbon at the time, so it was really caught my attention. And then through the promotion and kind of testing of that, I got to meet a lot of people that were in the industry kind of officially, started going to a lot of different events. And I was like, you know what? This is kind of the place that I'd like to spend the rest of my career. The people were great. Atmosphere was awesome. We always had a great time no matter what. So I just one day I told my boss, I was like, man, I'm done with engineering. I'm going in the bourbon industry, and got a job with ISC. They hired me after about 5 or 6 different interviews, me writing letters to the owner saying, you know, I really, really want this job. You know, I don't really have any experience in chemistry or anything.
I'm your guy.
Yeah. I am your guy. I'll learn very, very quickly. So
how did Brad take that, right?
Well, Brad's an engineer. And I think what really, really helped was I did have a little bit of a background in corn breeding for distillation. That was kind of a hobby that I did on the farm. I just kind of did on the side. It was very kind of a low key operation, but the guy that was my predecessor, he didn't really have any formal education, but you know, he kind of did my job as well. And he was kind of a tinkerer by nature. So he was just a very curious person. And apparently he worked out really well in that role. So I think what it was not necessarily my education, my background. I was passionate about bourbon and I think he appreciated that. But I think what he saw was that his nature for tinkering kind of lined up for mine. I was just a very curious person and just like to run experiments. So I think he's like, you know what? We can teach him the stuff. He's got the right kind of mindset for it. So I think that's really what it was.
Why did you seek them out? Versus going into distilling, you know, you see your chemical engineer or mechanical engineer. Why not be in manufacturing? Or what was it about the wood that excited you?
Well, actually, to be honest with you, I didn't really know it was with a cooperage until the first interview, because the job description was like working with, you know, different companies, whiskey companies to come up with new products and that kind of thing. And I was like, wow, this looks really, really cool. And it wasn't until, you know, I talked to the recruiter the first day that was, this is a cooperage. I'm like, wow, that's really, really cool.
If it was me getting into it, I'd be like, what's a cooperage?
Yeah. So, you know, it was a cooperage. I'm like, wow, this is getting really, really good. And then through the interviews, they just kind of explained to me, you know, what we'd be doing. And it just seemed like the dream job. I told Brad, I was like, I still don't believe this is what I'm going to be doing. So over the next few months, I did my training and sure enough, hopped right into it. It was awesome.
Was that the job that you have currently now, the research, the R&D?
Yeah, I've been in this job for over 5 years with ISC now.
So what was the R&D like back then when you first got into it?
So as far as like oak R&D, I mean, the research into barrels of maturation has been around for quite some time. But most of our research and innovation was done in the wine industry, because with bourbon, experimentation into barrels was happening, but it wasn't really credible. It was kind of like the mindset, you know, why fix it if it's not broke? The char four barrel works great and we make a lot of money selling these products. It wasn't until some of this, like the craft distillery boom and some of the heritage customers really started taking a turn into innovation and say, hey, there's a lot we can do with wood, Maker's Mark in particular. You know, I joke with those guys saying that their innovation program probably is the one that sparked the need for this job here. So anyways, they had some wine guys kind of moonlighting in the spirits industry, kind of taking care of some of these customers that wanted to experiment with different types of barrels. And I think once it grew to a certain point, that's like, okay, we need somebody full-time. Before me, I mean, there had been experimentation in the late 90s, early 90s, you know, with char levels, different wood species, wood seasoning times, and I'm sure we'll talk about all that and how it affects flavor. But the experiments were done. People tasted the whiskey. And again, it was just the fact that, you know, char threes and char fours were pumping out really, really good bourbon. And the craft distilling boom hadn't really hit yet. So there really wasn't any need for producers to be looking for differentiation. And then all this craziness happened and here we are.
what was the wine industry doing that kind of piqued the interest of people like makers or yourself, you know, to take, start doing those experimental or different chars or different toast or whatever?
Yeah, it kind of all centered around like the toast and what we call oak alternatives, which is kind of a weird term because it should be called barrel alternatives because they're still oak. But you had things like tank staves that went into wine for, you know, like kind of like low dollar wines that didn't have, you know, they didn't want to invest money in big expensive barrels. But, you know, they found out we could toast up the oak to different temperatures, create different flavors, put it in the wine, and we would get some really, really interesting stuff. And it just didn't take long to say, okay, well, let's differentiate from the char four a little bit. Let's put a different toast on this, or in the sense of Maker's Mark. And I hope they don't mind me, you know, dropping their name, you know, quite a bit here, but
I'm sure they love the publicity.
Yeah, I hope so. But, you know, they said, wow, well, let's try to take some of this innovation into oak and introduce it into bourbon right now. So that's kind of how it transitioned. It's just a few companies, the craft boom, and all of a sudden here we are.
So most people use like a standard three or four. What is it about the three or four that makes it like, I guess, a standard char versus like a one or two?
That's like a good question. So to start out with that, I mean, the charring system that we know today, the 1, 2, 3, 4, wasn't even standardized until the 1950s. All right. So everybody before then, there were a lot more cooperages, people probably getting blends of char ones, char halves, char fives, six, you know, kind of whatever came
whatever
down the line.
Out, yeah.
Yeah. There really wasn't.
Wait until you hit double digits. That's the one I want.
You left it on too long. Like my marshmallow.
Yeah. So as far as why the industry, you know, standardized on the actual char four, it was probably the mindset, you know, back then. A lot of this science was based on very early research, and it was kind of like, oh, if we char it a little bit, it creates, you know, this sort of, if we char it even more, it must create better flavors, you know. So it probably just got to the point where, okay, you know, char four is just the I Ching. So I can't really answer for sure why it was the char four instead of the char two, or why it was a minute long versus 30 seconds long was the standard. I'm not really sure.
Gotcha.
Dumb luck at that point.
I think so. Yeah. I think it just wasn't until it was probably like, okay, hey, we're going to standardize these different char levels. 10 seconds, 20 seconds, 35, 55, whatever it might be. And then the major distiller is like, okay, well, we want the deepest char. We want the, and that's probably how it happened.
Do you have a report of like how many of each char? Like, is it four and three, or is four like the most by far that people purchase, or is it?
So that's kind of a weird number just because the biggest distilleries purchase the char four. So there's more char four barrels out there, but I'm not sure char four is what most distilleries purchase, if that makes sense.
Gotcha.
Yeah, but we've gone all the way up into a char eight.
Oh. And what happened?
Actually, you know, contrary to popular belief, after char four, you start doing a little bit more harm than good. So you actually start robbing yourself of barrel components.
Diminishing returns after four.
Yeah, correct. And we experimented with that in the 90s as well. We did what we call it was essentially a char level eight. It was like a two and a half minute burn. Which I'm not even sure how they kept the barrel together at that point. Because after even a toasted char four barrel, it's about ready to...
Yeah, keel over
it. Yeah, keel over at that like, point, I don't for think, sure.
And these rings aren't doing its job anymore.
Yeah.
So talk about coming into this role and, you know, being in this role for 5 years, you've got your own experiments that you're starting, but you had to go and learn everything else that had worked or that had didn't work before you took this role. Mm-hmm. How much research and time was just invested in trying to figure out, like, somebody came and asked me if we can do this. Let me just go and look for our internal Wikipedia and see if this was actually done. Like, how did you learn all this sort of stuff?
So there's a couple of benefits. We have right now, what we have is like a whiskey library, and it's just a library of bottles for different experimentations, anything from, you know, wood species to, you know, seasoning times, that kind of thing. We had a few cases left over from the barrel symposiums back in the 90s. Now the barrel symposiums, what we did is we gathered up winemakers, distillers, and we had essentially, it's almost like a multi-day meeting. And the guys at ISC before me, they put different experiments into place at the distilleries. So we had a little bit of that whiskey left over. So I was able to read the Barrel Symposium books and get a little bit of an idea of kind of the things people were tinkering with and what the results were. That helped. The other thing that really, really helped was just reading as much as I could. As far as like journal entries, white papers, that kind of thing, dissertations, that's something I hit really, really hard within the first year, for sure. And, you know, nowadays, as far as, you know, knowledge, it's really all the knowledge that I've gained is from our experimental barrel program that we have. So it's kind of a continuation of those experiments, that same kind of program that we started in the 90s, fizzled out, and then we've kind of restarted. I think when I came in, we had a couple different experiments that were laid down. Very, very simple, char level, maybe a wood species, something like that. we probably had maybe 50 barrels. Now we have over 3,000 in experiment. So we've gone from about 50 barrels to about 3,000 in the course of 5 years.
So you need to call the Buzix yourselves to get warehouses made.
We can almost build our own warehouse. Yeah, we've got them spread out all over the world.
So talk about, like, how do you do that? Do you partner with other distillery, or do you have, are you doing it on site, or you, or how do you go about that experimental process?
We do a lot of experiments on site, and that's how we kind of back into barrel design through a lot of lab work. But the actual barrel program that we, I call it a barrel program, the experimental barrel program that we have is mostly partnerships with distilleries. So what we'll say is, okay, hey, we were in the lab, we saw this trend, we want to study it in a barrel format. Would you guys be willing to fill, you know, 24 barrels or 48 barrels with distillate and allow us to take samples, you know, every single year? And most of the time, the distilleries, they're very experimental as well, and they're happy to oblige.
So you just give them the barrel, say, we'll give these no charge. In return, we're going to take it, get feedback from it and whatnot.
Right. And then we give them, you know, yearly reports on the chemical analysis. At the end of the experiment, we provide a full report with sensory chemical, that kind of thing.
So what is it that you're looking for? Is it like flavors, or are you looking to speed up processes with different, or like, what are like some key, I want to say KPIs, but what are some, like, I guess, bullet points that you're trying to hit with these experiments?
Right. So a lot of it's just plain research, and some of it is innovation. By innovation, I mean new product design. So if we have an idea for a barrel, you know, we want to make sure that we test it thoroughly before we put it into production. So we'll test it out for 4 years, put it into production after that. So, and some of it's just research. So for instance, we have a climate experiment going right now where I've sent barrels to 6 different distilleries across the world in different microclimates. We had a producer actually make the whiskey in the same batch. Now, that's not really going to help us sell any barrels, but it helps us be really, really knowledgeable about the products that we sell. So it's kind of divided into two things there. You've got, let's test this out. This could be a new product line, or let's figure out why this is doing a certain thing in the climate experiment. You know, we were talking about, you know, Drew and the experiments that we have going with him. We have a warehouse experiment where, again, not really going to help us, you know, sell barrels or anything, but we want to know what's going on at each level. So that's one of those experiments. It's more based on research as opposed to innovation.
So when you're doing this one about that goes to, you know, 6 barrels and different places and microclimates, mm-hmm. what do you expect to happen? Like, do you start with a hypothesis and think this is what's going to possibly happen? Or do you wait to just let the data roll in and try to figure it out?
So we try to come up with a reason for doing the experiment, and that would be kind of that hypothesis saying, okay, this is what we hope to find out, like what is going on. But sometimes—
Let's justify the cost.
Right. Let's justify the cost of doing that, because a lot of these experiments, I mean, some of these barrels, you know, they're 150 barrel experiments. Some of them are 500 barrel experiments. Just kind of depends. So it can be a lot of money wrapped up into this.
I'd say so.
Yeah. Every now and then, you know, we'll get a wild hair and just say, hey, let's just try this and see what happens. And most of the time, my boss is pretty cool with that, which is great because, again, it is a big investment. So for those guys to be able to have that kind of faith and just say, hey, yeah, for sure, just learn as much as you can, that's a pretty cool environment to work in.
Yeah. And I've seen these reports, like Drew has shown me them, when they look like you're studying like the deep ocean or something.
Make sure people know what Drew you're talking about.
Drew Goldsveen with Willett Distillery. He is a good friend, and I knew he was doing experimentation with your all's barrels and stuff, and he had shown me the reports, and wow, it's like, I mean, they're like deep, in depth. Like I said, they look like meteorological reports or like weather reports. They're so in depth with so much information.
Yeah, no, they do get in depth, and there's a lot to talk about, a lot to discuss, and a lot to determine as far, you know, what's going on. And we're measuring, you know, not only barrel factors, but like environmental factors. And we're trying to relate that back to how the barrel's behaving. So there is a lot of stuff to tie back in and try to make sense of it all. It's very, very nice when that does happen. But there are certain periods or certain instances in which we can, you know, look at the results and say, you know,
that was a waste.
What? Well, not necessarily a waste, but like, why in the world did it taste like this? We can't really figure it
gotcha.
Out. Which is, that's pretty interesting too.
From the operation side, and I can understand the need to go and research different types of oaks, because you've got the standard American white oak. There's French oak and a bunch of other oaks. I know I've seen a bunch of stuff come out of like Warehouse X that they've been working on and stuff like that too over at Buffalo Trace. But I would think that another thing that you've got to figure out is what is the impact of our current geography and really what's happening in Earth of, do we have old oak versus new oak? What can we sustainably create a business out of depending on where we're getting our oak from? Are there some of those kind of experiments you're running as well?
So, you know, as far as sustainability goes, we have a pretty good partnership with the White Oak Initiative, which is, again, it's kind of a collaboration between a lot of different companies, universities, in which we, you know, study sustainability and that kind of thing, preservation, just make sure that we, you know, preserve this resource, figure out how to make it last if something bad were to happen. As far as experiments into flavor, we're kind of limited just because we like to, how do I say this? We like to control the log all the way from the essentially the forest all the way to the cooperage. So we like to keep, or we like to offer products that we can readily get our hands on. So again, it's fun to study these alternative species like black sea oak or mizanar or something like that, but it's just not something that we can keep a steady supply of. And if you have customers, you know, like Jim Beam, you got to be very, very careful when you show customers, you know, hey, here's an exotic oak. And they go, oh, we'd like 10,000 barrels. And it's kind of like, well, we can't do that. So as far as flavor goes, the oaks that we experiment with the most, the ones that we offer are the European oak, the French oak, and then obviously the American white oak. But there's, you know, 600 different species of oak out there. A lot of them aren't suitable for barrels, but there's a lot of different options for
is,
sure.
Is there any research into like oaks growing, you know, the same species, white oak grown in different, you know, parts of the country, or even like on the same property, but on this side of that property, you know, that might be the honey hole for growing oak versus over there. Yeah. You know, cause I that happens in grapes or any other thing you're harvesting, you know,
it's a really, really good question. And I mean, there have been initiatives to study that kind of thing. I can say with confidence that
might be getting too in the weeds. And
no, it's not necessarily getting too in the weeds. From what I have seen about, let's say an oak tree that grows in Missouri, as opposed to Kentucky, what I have seen in terms of tasting, again, it's very, very limited because it's not something we study really, really in depth. But from what I've seen, and we have done a few experiments, is I kind of equate that kind of differences in flavor towards what I call like the Best Buy analogy. So if you walk into a Best Buy, you'll see them put like a really, really nice TV next to a really kind of a value TV. And the reason they do that is because if you were to take that really, really nice TV, put it in one room, take the other one, put it in another room, and kind of walk back and forth, it would be really, really hard right to tell the difference. So with experiments like that, with American white oak grown in two different places, you can tell a difference on paper as far as chemically, but if you were to taste them side by side, you could tell a difference. But if you were to taste, you know, one day the next, it's very, very difficult to do.
Sure. And then when you're logging them and milling them and they're all getting mixed in together and stuff, it kind of...
Yeah, it's very hard to separate in the mills, especially at the pace that we produce. So, it's hard for us to say, oh, we can only guarantee Kentucky oak or Missouri oak. And again, sure, from the experiments that I've tasted, the flavor differences aren't anywhere near as severe as like changing up a char level or a toast level or going from a different species.
Call it small batch oak.
Yeah,
that's what it is at the end of the day. You know, you just get it all together. You
could be 100 oak trees, or it could be,
you know, maybe some 30 years. You know, they all get mixed in there.
Yeah, what is the average age of, I guess, of a harvested oak tree?
You're going to look somewhere between probably 80 to 130 years old.
Oh, wow. Cool.
Yeah. And, you know, you want to start to get that tree right before it starts to rot. And obviously, rotted wood's not going to make a very good barrel. So usually 130 years, kind of the top end right there.
Yeah, and I also want listeners to know that the cooperage industry doesn't use near as much wood as the housing industry. So if people are thinking like, oh my God, there's so much waste or anything going on, it's not the case at all.
Yeah, we're less than 5% of the market of hardwoods. I mean, you know, pulp, paper, flooring, those are the big
things.
You
all have such great, like you were talking about, initiatives and, you know, their programs to like, that you're investing in the future, and there's actually more white oak species now than there has been in the past 30 or 40 years, just because of the smart planning of, you know, harvesters way back when.
We've wised up in the past several decades. I mean, there's 2.5 times more harvestable white oak now than there was 40 years ago. And that's harvestable white oak. So that's a really, really good sign. And again, Brad Boswell, our president, who you guys have interviewed before, he takes a pretty, you know, firm stance on making sure that we're doing everything we can to not only use every bit of the trees that we cut down, but also, you know, preserve the resource.
What's something like a distiller, I guess, what's a common thing or like the most thing they're like looking for when they're like, hey, I want to try something new. What, you know, I want this, I want that. Or I don't know. Do you get those a lot where they seek you out like, hey, help me out?
Yeah, that's something that requires a pretty good portion of my day or my week. Is, you know, with the craft guys, it's a one thing. With the heritage guys, it's usually something. With the craft guys, you know, they don't have the luxury of, number one, sitting on barrels for a long time. And they also don't have 9-story warehouses where they can pull and get different flavors and all that kind of stuff. So they need points of differentiation. you know, they need something that's going to taste different than a char four, because it's really hard to compete with distilleries that have been around for, you know, so long and have really, really good stocks of whiskey. So the craft guys are looking for points of differentiation. The heritage guys are looking for the next new thing, like new products and stuff like that. Maturation is the easiest thing to vary by far. If you can take one liquid stream and make six different products, that's ideal. And you can do that by changing your barrel up.
What do you think is the most bang for buck for product differentiation?
What is the most bang for your buck?
Well, like, say I'm looking to you and I'm like, hey, I really want, you know, something to differentiate, but I don't want to be too off profile. What are you going to like lean me towards?
Yeah. Like, give us an idea of like, which, if we were craft distillers when we came in, like, what would you steer us towards? What would you say? These are the options that are available to you.
Right. So we're going to ask you a bunch of different questions first. We're going to ask you, you know, what are you making?
Wheat whiskey.
So what is going to be the goals? Obviously, do you want something?
Sell a lot of it.
So that's good. So you want this
right when it turns four.
Right. So you want this thing to be out in, you know, 2 years or something like that, where you have a shelf of a product in 2 years. So what we're going to teach you is the dynamics of charring, wood species, which ones are good for which products. So what I'm going to tell you, if you want a 2 year old wheat whiskey and you want to get it on the shelf, first thing I'm going to tell you is, you know, one of the, you know, key indicators of an older whiskey, a very nice aged whiskey, is more extractives in the barrel, more flavors. So what's going to give you the most extractives the quickest is going to be a toasted char one barrels. A lot of people don't realize is that char fours develop the slowest. Char ones develop a little bit faster. So we'll lower the char level down. We'll make sure the whiskey gets to the red layer as quick
Why
as possible.
Why is that?
It's a little bit complicated, but...
Get nerdy on us. Go for it.
No, we can. I mean, essentially, there's no flavor in the charred layer at all, right? So if we put a char four on there, it's got a pretty thick charred layer. The whiskey actually has to get through that. And
it's mostly just filtering, I guess.
Yeah, the filters. Yeah. And with a char four barrel, a lot of the flavors that are developed, they kind of sit near the back of the stave, as opposed to like a char one barrel, where we actually move those flavors a little bit closer. So you get a broad range of flavors a lot quicker, as opposed to a charge four. We're just moving everything closer. And then, you know, we'll say, do you have any flavor goals in mind? Yeah, we want it sweet, we want it spicy, that kind of thing. If that's the case, we'll put a toast profile on there that gives you a heavy dose of eugenol, which is going to be clove or spice. If you want sweet, we'll give you a toast profile that gives you a heavy dose of vanillin. So, you know, over the past 2 or 3 years, we've gotten really, really geeky in maturation programs and getting very, very specific to where we're tailoring barrels to certain mash bills.
All right, so say we want to do a 2 year rye whiskey. Where are we going down now?
Customers are rushing to your store. Do you have a point of sale system you can trust, or is it a real POS? You need Shopify for retail. Shopify POS is your command center for your retail store. From accepting payments to managing inventory, Shopify has everything you need to sell in person. And with Shopify, you get a powerhouse selling partner that effortlessly unites your in-person and online sales into one source of truth. Track every sale across your business in one place and know exactly what's in stock. Connect with customers in line and online. Shopify helps you drive store traffic with plug-and-play tools built for marketing campaigns from TikTok to Instagram and beyond. And you can get hardware that fits your business. Take payments by smartphone, transform your tablet into a point-of-sale system, or use Shopify's POS Go mobile device for a battle-tested solution. Plus, Shopify's award-winning 24/7 help is there to support your success every step of the way. Do retail right with Shopify. Sign up for $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/bourbon, all lowercase, and go to shopify.com/bourbon to take your retail business to the next level today. shopify.com/bourbon.
All right, so say we want to do a 2 year rye whiskey. Where are we going down now?
So if we're going to do a 2 year rye whiskey, I'm going to say, you know, a 2 year rye whiskey is going to do just fine, like a char three.
We're basically giving away all of his consultation right here for free.
Well, we get to our customers, our consultation is free. So I mean,
yeah, you could, they even just if you're want the barrels,
yeah, even if you were to call up and we, you know, you could come to the R&D center and you could taste through all these different whiskeys and we could show you all this kind of stuff. But you know, rye whiskey is going to develop a lot quicker, so you can say, hey, you'll be fine, you know, putting it at char three or char four. That's going to be great. But if you really want to get some extractives in there, get a little bit more barrel forward, we can put you into, you know, a toasted char one or char two. I would probably steer you away from a spice profile because it just doesn't work. And I would probably bounce it out with a like, you know, a butterscotch or some brown sugar or something like that, or maybe some smoke.
How do you get the butterscotch or brown sugar in there?
So there's two main components in a barrel that make up oak. It's like hemicellulose and lignin. Those are the two components that we kind of study the degradation chains of. And there's almost the systematic breakdown of those things. And that's, I'm putting it kind of black and white there, but it's kind of like if you toast it to one temperature, you get an array of these flavors. Toast to a different temperature, you destroy those flavors, but build up a concentration of this one. So over 25 years of doing this, we've kind of got a really, really nice flavor wheel that we can kind of pick from. Certain wood species are going to give you heavier concentrations of certain flavors. Certain seasoning times, they're going to do, you know, they're going to give you a different range of flavors. So through the combination of all those different parameters that you can mess around with, you can start to tailor the barrel to the product that's going in, how long it's going to stay in, what kind of flavors you want, what kind of mouthfeel, that kind of thing.
You stole the question out of my mouth of like, well, how do you know what kind of toast level? Like, do you use like propane? Do you use butane? Like, how do you know the exact kind of toast level to kind of go on these things? But you kind of hit it there. But the one thing that we didn't talk about was the stave seasoning and, mm-hmm. and the aging of where it sits in outside. So kind of talk about that and how that plays a huge role into this.
Yeah. I mean, you know, seasoning, I'm a big believer in it, and we have a lot of customers that, you know, believe in it as well. So with our spirit barrels, we go anywhere between, you know, kind of the 3 to 6 month all the way up to 24 month. And wine barrels, it's not uncommon to see like 48 month seasoning. There's a couple of different things it does. Probably that's most famous for removing tannins. So if you've got something like a low entry proof, and you know, tannins like water. So the more water you put in the mixture, tannins can become a problem as it ages. So seasoning is a good way to kind of soften that effect. Seasoning also gives you kind of a jump start on your extractive process. So it breaks down some of those larger constituents, turns them into more flavorful or more favorable components. And it does give you about a 20% boost in extractives, not all the way across the board, but in some key components it does. So for a younger whiskey or a double barrel, you know, seasoning is a really, really good thing to do.
What about, so say I want to do my rye whiskey in Texas versus New York. Was there any differences you would say in
Yeah, that's tough, man. I mean, Texas is...
You're like, move to Kentucky.
Yeah, no, Texas is a tough place to age a whiskey. And I think, you know, part of that is just kind of embracing, you know, what you have to deal with and just trying to get the widest array of flavors into the barrel as quick as possible.
Yeah, but there's nothing about the barrels that can like slow down evaporation or like kind mm-hmm. of make it not as fast. It is what it is.
It is kind of what it is. I mean, there are some things that have some theory behind them, you know, that can kind of maybe reduce, you know, evaporation. It's theory. I'm not really sure the validity behind it. It's just something that, you know, we've not really been a big believer in. It's been tested before and the results were mixed. Let's just say that. But I mean, you could always go to a bigger barrel. I mean, if you really, really wanted to, you could go to like a 300 liter barrel and that'll slow down the extraction quite a bit. But again, I think aging in hot environments is saying, okay, end of story, we're just not gonna be able to keep the whiskey in the barrel that long. That's just the end of story. So we got to figure out how to get the right combination of flavors into the barrel in this amount of time and just build a really nice complex product.
So I guess one of the things that I want to kind of get back to is this idea of everything you did at Makers. Mm-hmm. So kind of talk about the process of helping them figuring out stave profiles. And if you worked with, you know, Bill Samuels, if you worked with Jane Bowie about all this other kind of stuff of A, figuring out and kind of telling the story of where the names came from too.
So, you know, as far as working with Makers, I mean, they pretty much have everything set up in line as far as the flavor, what they call the flavor vision. So they've got essentially everything all laid out right before when I get there as far as like, hey, we got this new project and here's exactly what we want it to taste like. You know, here's the story behind it. And then, you know, they'll give me some whiskey. I'll go to the lab and just try to figure out how to, you know, get these different flavors that they're looking for out of the whiskey. Some of them are adding barrel flavors, which is very easy. That was like the 2020 release. The 2019 RC6, that was a little bit more difficult because the object there was not to add barrel flavor. It was to add an oak component that would elevate yeast character. So that was really, really difficult to do.
Whatever you did, I got almond milk latte out of that. I remember. It was true. It was so good.
Yeah, so that one took us a little bit. But yeah, as far as, you know, Maker's Mark goes, their wood innovation program is pretty awesome. You know, they've got a lot of great ideas and they love to experiment, which I think helps out. But essentially, they've got everything laid out for me. They give me the goals and I just go away for however long I need. And then I'll bring them back 5 or 6 different samples and just, I won't tell them anything about it. I'll give them to Jane and, you know, her and Beth, and they'll taste it and say, okay, this is the one that's on track. We'll take that one. We'll do a couple more iterations of it. And eventually we get it nailed down.
What do you think about them getting rid of the mocha stave on their private blends?
Yeah. I mean, that was, you know, I guess it's fine. You know, whatever they want to do. That was a really, really good stave.
I know.
We're like, hello. Gosh, well, I mean, that was a really, really good stave. It was one of my favorites for sure. But
man, I love that cuvee one. Just, it's like, remind me of old granddad or something by itself, like butterscotch.
I'm more of a vanilla guy as far as it comes to bourbon. So the Pure 2 stave is my favorite. But this new one that they just came out with, the Mondeon, is...
The Mondeon, what's Mondeon, that?
It's the new stave that replaced the Mocha.
Okay.
And it's pretty good as well.
We haven't been there yet. What's
I mean, I guess, like? Talk about the development of it. Like, how do you, I know I've heard, you know, put them in convection and all this other kind of stuff to mm-hmm. try and pull some of these different flavors out. Give us a little more detail there.
If you can.
Yeah, no, I can, up to a certain extent. I mean, as far as the development goes, you know, the difficult thing with the private select is that it's not like a singular product, right? There's a wide array of things that this could be once you add a new stave to it. So getting a stave to taste a certain way is one thing, but then you have to make sure that that stave blends well with the others and it doesn't overpower, doesn't underpower, doesn't make bad flavors when you get it in certain combinations. So that's really kind of the legwork of developing a new stave for Private Select. It's not necessarily getting the stave that's going to give you the right flavor. It's getting the stave that's going to blend together and give you the right flavor. So that, I mean, that took 4 years to do.
Wow.
Yeah. Let's say, and we tried, I don't know how many hundreds of staves that we tried, but it just takes a long time. And people think 4 years, but it's, you know, it's not like we're working on every day. I mean, you know, we're aging the whiskey for a matter of, you know, a couple months, and then we're tasting it, and then they have to go back and the people at Makers have to blend all it with different combinations. So, I mean, it's a lot of work that they have to do for sure. I got the easy part and the Maker's Mark development. So yeah, they've got the hard job.
So do you have a special day set aside for tasting experiments? And you're like, it's tasting day. Let's go at it.
Friday is research day.
That's what we call it, research
day. Yeah, research day. But, you know, anytime, whatever Jane needs, you know, she can just call and, you know, we'll do whatever they need for sure.
You're right down the road.
Yeah,
we'll pop in. Yeah, it's, you know, hey, you know, sometimes, hey, can I come over and, you know, I got an idea. Or, you know, she said, hey, can you come over and taste this? So it's a great relationship with Maker's Mark. Definitely interesting. Always learn something, but we don't really necessarily have a day set aside for tastings. I mean, we get whiskey in all the time that we have to taste. We have a sensory panel that works out of my office. So, you know, we do that a lot. But as far as a dedicated day, no, I mean, Friday's research day. So you can kind of gather why we made it on Friday.
It's probably go to lunch and then call it a day after that. Then
that's right. Don Draper lunch.
So,
is it easier to work with Maker's Mark because their product's so consistent versus, you know, because they're rotating barrels and try to hit, whereas other distilleries have a, you know, like they're in different areas of the warehouse could bring up different flavor profiles?
Yeah. Anytime you have a consistent base, it makes things a lot easier. I mean, there's not really distilleries that are difficult to work with. I mean, it's all fun. It's all different. So everybody provides, you know, kind of a unique experience for us in the research department. But yeah, with any distillery, if you've got a base product and it's going to be very, very consistent, that makes things very, very easy for sure.
Do you see any differences in, like, I guess I'm just thinking about like Heaven Hill's new 50,000 barrel warehouses versus like one of Drew has 5,000 barrels or some? Do you see wide differentiations in, you know, how the barrels react in those certain circumstances, or is it to be determined?
So there are differences. Most of the distilleries, they do their own research in that, and I've been privy to a little bit of that. I can't really say anything about it, but, you know, we have warehouse experiments. We can definitely, you know, gather that there's going to be some differences between a 50,000 and a 5,000, just based off, you know, sure, thermodynamics and that kind of thing. But we, ISC, have not gotten the privilege yet to put in our own experiment where we would study a 50,000 versus 20,000, get whiskey back, run a chemical analysis, and since we haven't done that yet.
I mean, I guess the tough part is that this is not something that you say, let's go ahead and do this. We'll come back next week. I mean, this is based on years.
Yeah, I mean, with
nothing fast in bourbon industry.
No. Yeah, it's usually with our experiments, unless we're doing like a double barrel experiment or something like that. I mean, at the minimum, they're 4 years. So if we want to launch a new product, the products that are launching today, like our new product lines, I mean, those were 4 years in the making.
So how about the rise of double barrels, or, you know, what
oh,
about that?
Gosh, yeah, the toasted barrel, like, rise and the double barreled of everything.
It was,
yeah,
like Michter's, right? Toasted, I think, was the first one I remember. And then now it's like everyone has one. Like, what is it about it that people love?
Well, as far as double barreling or just as far as toasted goes?
Well, it's both, a combination.
Combination,
yeah. I mean, so, people are taking their aged whiskey and then rebarreling it into a toasted barrel to kind of give it different flavor profiles. And it started off with, I think you're right, Michter's. And then from there, everybody else has said, sure, we'll do that too.
Yeah. So a couple different things there. I mean, number one, toasted barrel just sounds good.
It does.
You know, so yeah. I mean, you know, 80% of what you taste is going to be, you know, it's going to filter through your brain first before it ever gets to your olfactory. So that's a big part of it. I mean, toasted barrel sounds good and therefore it is going to be good. It just so happens that toasted barrels are very, very potent in terms of flavor. I mean, they put out a lot of flavor because there's no char layer to go through, right? Toasted barrels are also very, very precise. So you can put a very, very precise flavor profile into that barrel without having to add a char. Charring disrupts the toast profile, makes it a little bit less accurate. But essentially, as soon as that whiskey hits the barrel, it's running into nothing but flavor. So they're just really potent. They have a lot of mouthfeel. They're thick. They can usually produce flavors that are easy for people to pick out, which I think is another reason why a lot of people, you know, enjoy those things. But it just adds a lot of flavor.
Is there certain numbers of toast or levels like there are chars, or is it?
I mean, just on
or do you just tell you what flavors and you're like, we'll take care of it from here.
We'll take the cinnamon one.
Yeah, no, and it kind of started out as we had a off the shelf of about 150 different flavor toast profiles, and it was kind of like, okay, we can't just throw this book at a customer because they don't know what they're doing. So now we've
I need five. Yeah.
The way that we preferred is we've actually designed a new series of barrels, and you know, forgive the naming convention here. We're not very creative, but it's the Sweet One, Sweet Two, Spice One, and Smoke One.
Love it.
So we designed four toast profiles. Stupid, right? Yeah, to give you very specific flavors so people know. But I mean, we create customized toast profiles for distilleries on a weekly basis.
And I guess with the toast stuff, is it the same thing as a bourbon? Is it one and done and you got to get another bourbon barrel? Or is there a lot of ways that people can use them twice or anything like that? But I guess maybe they wouldn't be a straight bourbon whiskey if they tried to use it in a used barrel. But I'm just kind of curious if there's anything else that you could pull out of a used barrel or a toasted barrel, or if it's just kind of needs to go on to the furniture store after that.
So, I mean, in general, I'm not trying to get into the, you know, the TTB regulations, because that's kind of a whole different story. And we've kind of become self-taught experts in that through all the different barrel applications that we've done. But I mean, generally speaking, in Kentucky, and it's going to vary depending on which climate you're in, but your extraction period is going to last anywhere between 2 to 4 years. So that's where you're going to get a heavy amount of extractives in. So most of the toasted barrel applications that we design for are going to be less than 10 weeks. So you still have a lot of flavor left in those barrels. Now, after you use it once, as you said, it's not really a new barrel anymore. So that takes some things out of, you couldn't just call it a straight bourbon whiskey. It has to be, you know, straight bourbon whiskey finished in a used barrel or finished in a once-used toasted barrel or some kind of label craziness going on there.
But on the back. Yeah, tucked in the back.
We'll figure that one out later.
The point is that if you use a barrel for a very short time, a matter of weeks, a month, even a year, there's still going to be plenty of flavor left in that. So, yeah, I mean, reusing it. It's not in my interest to say keep reusing the barrels because we want to make new ones, but we want to be the best consultants. So, yeah, absolutely. If you've got a bourbon product and you've got an American whiskey on your line too, reuse the toasted barrel for sure.
So you've been doing this for 5 years now in this role, mm-hmm. and you've started your own experiments. You've seen some that have come in. Can you name one that you tried and you were like, oh, this was a mistake. Like, we're never going to do this.
Thought this was going to be a winner.
Yeah. Where do I start? I mean, we fail, you know, more times than we. The good news is working with new barrels, if you toast it and you char it, there's really not much you can. I mean, it's going to produce some really, really good flavors, but you know, there are some applications like triple barreling and stuff like that where like, okay, that don't ever do that again. Or, you know, we've tried, you know, double barreling, like, you know, 15-year-old whiskey, you know, don't do that again. So there are some failures and stuff like that, but nothing that really sticks out is like, oh my gosh, don't throw this stuff away. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Most of the time it turns out okay.
I mean, we've really went into, you know, the history and the science and everything that you really kind of put forth here today. And I feel that as a consumer and as a lot of our listeners or consumers out there, do you feel that, and I'm probably thinking this myself, do we take the barrel for granted and all the work that goes into it? Because I feel that it should be more like what Maker's Mark does for, you know, for the private selection barrels. It should be something where maybe it's on the label that says this was in 24-month air dried stave barrels with the level whatever char, and the customers love that transparency. Do you kind of feel that
ISC should be on the label
or something
that badge of honor?
I mean, do you feel like we all kind of take it for granted a little bit because it seems like it's still so behind the scenes.
It's very behind the scenes. I mean, you know, the barrel, it, you know, is responsible for a lot. But you have to do the front end procedure correctly. I mean, you have to have the good whiskey. But, you know, I think the majority, and I think us being in Kentucky and, you know, being knee deep in this stuff, I think we get a little bit of a biased opinion on, you know, what is cool and, you know, what's interesting. I mean, I'm a nerd. So, yeah, I would want every detail of the barrel on the bottle if I could have it, just because I think that's kind of stuff is interesting. But, you know, a lot of people just like bourbon and they're okay with it just tasting really, really good. They could, you know, we do these trade shows and, you know, we do different, like the, what's the bourbon festival? We do the New Orleans Bourbon Festival. We do these presentations to consumers. And they could, some of them could care less about whether it's a char one, char two, right. Char three, char four.
It tastes good.
Yeah. Right.
That's a lot.
And then you have a portion of the, you know, the demographic that's just really into it and asking a whole lot of questions. So I don't know if I could really answer your question or not. I think it's just going to be
both split. Sides.
It's going to be dependent on who you ask. Some people just love bourbon and love to drink it, and that's enough for them. They like the story more so than they like the process. Yeah. And that's great. That's how I started off for sure. I didn't care about a char three or char four. This stuff just tastes good to me. But I think the more you get into it, it's just kind of a natural evolution. You're going to want to know as much as you can.
So say I got bad distillate. Is there something you can
do? How can you fix it?
What barrel are you going to recommend to fix? No, I'm kidding.
No, well, I mean, we get that. I mean, in the age of, you know, source whiskey, which there's a lot of that stuff out right now, we get, say, hey, we got a bad batch and, you know, it's not really tasting good. Can you do anything to mask that? I mean, and there are
certain, do a secondary finished or double barrel too.
Right. And that's a great way to do that. Yeah, there's certain that barrels sense. You would use and there's certain barrels you wouldn't. But, you know, there's a lot of times where there's certain faults in the whiskey that you just can't cover up.
So every source product I know is double barreled. I'm like, it was a bad batch. And now I'm getting it.
We know what they're trying to hide.
Yeah. No. Well, the other thing is that, you know, a lot of people, especially when this whole thing started off, I mean, a lot of people were buying the same juice. You know, there wasn't very many people sourcing or selling aged whiskey. So it was like, you know, how do we differentiate from the rest of the people that are sourcing? And again, double barreling is a great way to do that.
For sure. Now, has there ever been kind of like one of the last questions here? Has there ever been a time where a customer has asked you for something so asinine or off the wall that you're like, we can't do that? It's impossible.
And they've been persistent.
there's a couple instances in which, and I said, you know, we want to sell barrels too. And we'd love to tell you, but, you know, we're brutally honest. You know, if somebody sends us a whiskey in and they have just some unreal flavor goals, like we want to do a 2-year-old whiskey, we want it to have like, you know, vanilla and this and that. We're like, you know, you just can't do that. I mean, we've had guys send us, you know, they're starting distilleries and they send us a bottle like Buffalo Trace. Like, we want our whiskey to taste like this.
Yeah.
So, you know, we have to explain that's just not, even if you had the exact same equipment, exact same recipe, everything, it's still going to taste different. And there are times when, you know, we get a whiskey in and it's just pristine. And we give them our honest opinion, say if it was up to us, we wouldn't even touch it.
So
Char four, let it ride.
Yeah, we try to be as honest as we can.
So one last question for, there's a lot of Mizanara casks, you know, coming up. Do you think that's here to stay or that's going to be a new trend? It seems like a lot of people are kind of going, you know, down that path also.
Yeah,
what is it about the Mizanara that makes it an attractive species?
I think it's just kind of the exotic nature of the species.
It does sound exotic.
It does. It's very hard to get. And there are some producers over there that keep a pretty tight handle on it. I mean, we try to get some for experimentation. They're like, well, what are you going to use it for? This, that. So they want a lot of specifics. So for that reason, I don't know if it'll ever really catch on and be like this huge craze. Obviously, it sounds great, but it's just very, very low supply.
It's like limited bourbon. Everybody wants what they can't have.
That's exactly it. And again, yeah. Mizanara oak just sounds really, really good.
It does sound fancy. Oak.
Yeah.
Sounds high dollar.
Yeah.
It definitely does.
Yeah. It could catch on if there was enough of it. I'm not a particular fan of it just because I think it's overly spicy and I'm just not a big fan of real spicy bourbon, but there are plenty of people out there that like it. I mean, it makes a fine whiskey.
Yeah, for sure. Well, Andrew, I want to say thank you so much for coming on the show today. You definitely schooled us and I think you gave the consumer a much better appreciation for the work that not just you all, but you represent a lot of, you know, the other cooperages out there and you kind of make people understand that there's a lot of work that happens in the back end. And that's what makes the difference of, you know, what your bourbon's going to be like versus something, you know, the different char levels, the way that the producer anticipates it, what they want it to be like and how it ultimately ends up in their bottles and their hands.
Yeah, man, there's a lot that goes into it, you know, especially when it comes to the barrel. I mean, there's a lot that goes into it you don't see, period, whether it's the distillery or the cooperage. So it's definitely a fascinating job. And if people are interested in it, I mean, our cooperage is open for tours. You know,
we're back open.
Yeah, please come on by and check us out, see what we're all about for sure.
Well, I guess we'll kind of give you that. So if people do want to find out more about ISC and take a tour, how do they do it?
Yeah, the best place to go is, you know, you can go to our, you know, our Instagram, ISC Barrels, iscbarrels.com. that'll lead you right to the place where you can sign up for tours and that kind of thing. But we do tours in Kentucky, and definitely love to have you. Yeah, for sure.
You got to be there to see the see the fire, right? You got to see it all.
You come, out smelling like a cooperage. Everybody loves it for sure.
Campfire.
Yeah. No. Exactly.
Yeah. I mean, who needs an air freshener in their car when you just go to take a cooperage tour?
Yeah, man. Those barrel. It's funny. I have an old barrel that was rotting out in my woods. I threw in my fire. God damn, that thing lit up like it was awesome.
Yeah. No. It's I do have some staves to burn when I'm in my house, so I know a guy. But yeah, we get some of the used barrels back, and you know, we'll study them, take them down, then break them down, and then I'll usually take the wood home, and makes great firewood for
it
sure.
It does.
All right, God. Last question then. So you get a used barrel back. What do you anticipate, or what do you look at? What are you looking for?
Most of the time, when we get a look, at least in my department, you know, we're studying like absorption rates. So you know, how far the whiskey seeps in the barrel, over how long. You know, that kind of thing. And
what's
again,
the farthest you've seen it go in there?
It's going out of the wood on the other side. Yeah.
Well,
yeah. No, I mean,
barrel. Oh, we'll talk about leaky barrels.
Oh, you have to. Yeah.
Well, I'd say about halfway through for the most part. Now, I mean, it's really hard to look at it because really what you see going through the middle of that stave, there's components in there, but they're only ones that had an interaction that actually made a color. So we've actually tested staves all the way through. We found distillate components past that red line is what everybody kind of calls it. So you can look at a stave and say, okay, it went this far, but to really get an idea of how far the whiskey made it through, you have to kind of take that stave, tear it apart, grind it up, extract it, and then, you know, see how far those different acids and stuff that don't produce colors or interactions with oxygen. That's how you really see how far. So as far as I've seen, maybe half or maybe in between half and three quarters.
Okay.
All right.
There's the other. Oh, you got
one last question. The leaky barrel theory.
We don't make leaky barrels.
Well, fair enough.
I love it.
But some people say that leaky barrels are, you know, make some of the better single barrels. And we know Bill Thomas has taken some barrels, drained half of them to see, like, and we haven't got any research. Do you do any research on that? Well, probably not, because you don't want to sell leaky barrels.
No, but we definitely don't sell. I mean,
but is there a theory or something kind of?
There could be. You know, some theories, and I think, you know, one of the things, a strategy that we often tell people to employ is short filling barrels. A lot of the maturation, again, happens past the initial extraction period. And to start doing a lot of that maturation, you have to have headspace in that barrel, because that's where the majority of the oxygen is going to get replenished, right, is in that headspace. So if you can jumpstart that process, right, and start getting some of those oxidative reactions to occur a little bit quicker, that works out pretty good.
So what are we talking, leaving out 5 gallons, 10 gallons?
Yeah. I mean, yes. You know, whatever you want to do. I mean,
it's called an experiment, Ryan. Yeah. Figure it out yourself.
48 gallons.
Yeah. I mean, we sell new barrels, so if you just want to short fill it to about half.
We don't care.
Yeah, that'd be fine.
Just buy the 53.
Yeah, exactly. So yeah, that is a technique, and I've seen that work really, really well. Proofing down in the barrels and their technique we've seen work really, really well. So there, I think if there is going to be, you know, any kind of validity to, you know, the leaker barrels produce really, really good whiskey, it was probably be because they had just a greater amount of headspace for a longer period of time.
There we go.
Makes sense.
Now we've got it. I think we've got all our questions. If we're not, we're going to have you come back on again, because I'm sure we'll have that come at some point.
Sure. A lot more to talk about.
Yeah. But Andrew, thank you again for once again coming on the show. Make sure you follow ISC Barrels. Go and take a tour. You're not going to take a tour of anything that we have, but you can follow us on all of our socials as well. Bourbon Pursuit. .com, as well as, you know, Bourbon Pursuit everywhere else. But with that, cheers, everybody. Thank you so much, and we'll see you all next week.
Thanks, guys.
Cheers.